Okay, everyone, I'm going to start now. Today I'm going to be talking about Jane Austen's Emma, and there's some handouts going around. I think they've made their way about halfway down the room, and they're still circulating. So last week, Michael Hulse was talking to you about the 18th century epistolary novel. So by way of bridging the gap, so to speak, between last week's lecture and this week's lecture on Emma, I'm going to begin with an extract. There are some handouts down here. Let me pick them up. I'm going to begin with an extract from an epistolary novel written in 1790. The novel is called Love and Friendship, and the spelling is entirely the author's own, by the way. It's not mine. The novel is called Love and Friendship. The author was 14 years old at the time when she wrote it, and her name was Jane Austen. Now, the novel wasn't published in Austen's lifetime. It was clearly written for the entertainment and amusement of her immediate circle of family and friends. And in this extract, in the first extract on your handout, Laura is describing her first meeting with her new best friend. This letter, describing her first meeting with her new best friend. So this is the first extract on the handout. After having been deprived, during the course of 3 weeks, of a real friend, for such I term your mother, imagine my transports at beholding one most truly worthy of the name. Sophia was rather above the middle size, most elegantly formed. A soft languor spread over her lovely features, but increased their beauty. It was the characteristic of her mind. She was all sensibility and feeling. We flew into each other's arms, and after having exchanged vows of mutual friendship for the rest of our lives, instantly unfolded to each other the most inward secrets of our hearts. We were interrupted in the delightful employment by the entrance of Augustus, Edward's friend, who was just returned from a solitary ramble. Never did I see such an affecting scene as was the meeting of Edward and Augustus. My life, my soul, exclaimed the former. My adorable angel, replied the latter, as they flew into each other's arms. It was too pathetic for the feelings of Sophia and myself. We fainted alternately on a sofa. Okay, so you've got it. I mean, this is a comic novel. It's designed to be a comic novel in which the young Austen is kind of reveling in her own ability to play with words, but and in her own exuberance and absurdity. And Austen is able to rely, sort of for comic effect, on the familiarity of her audience with the particular genre which she's pastiching here, which is the 18th century novel of sensibility. And that's my first topic for this lecture, really. I'm going to start by looking at the idea of sensibility. I'm going to move on to talk about the idea of the Bildungsroman, and then I'm going to move in more closely on Emma as a novel which invites but also is about interpretation. So the novel of sensibility. This is the genre to which many of the novels discussed by Michael Hulse in last week's lecture belong. Novels by Goethe, Samuel Richardson, Rousseau, and many others. Okay, so sensibility, what was it? Are you familiar with the term? Is it a familiar term? No. Okay, well, now you're going to have a lightning introduction to the idea of sensibility. Highly fashionable. Janet, I'm going to give you an extract from Janet Todd's very useful introduction to the whole idea of sensibility in her book, Sensibility, an Introduction. And what she does is to give among other things, is to give an account of the rise and fall of the fashion for the whole idea of sensibility. So this is number two on the handout. The cult of sensibility was largely defined by fiction from the 1740s to the 1770s. This fiction initially showed people how to behave, how to express themselves in friendship, and how to respond decently to life's experiences. Later, it prided itself more on making its readers weep and in teaching them when and how much to weep. In addition, it delivered the great archetypal victims, the chaste suffering woman, happily rewarded in marriage or elevated into redemptive death, and the sensitive benevolent man, whose feelings are too exquisite for the acquisitiveness, vulgarity, and selfishness of his world. So it was a genre with initially a didactic impetus, although this changes. And as Todd says, sensibility is one of the key terms, the most bandied about terms of the latter half of the 18th century. So it's quite useful to be familiar with it. And as I said, initially, the novel of sensibility had a didactic aim. It was aiming to inculcate the capacity for refined and delicate emotion and compassion for suffering, which was associated with a kind of general impulse towards benevolence, philanthropy, generosity, and so on. But by the late 18th century, when Austin was writing Love and Friendship, the fashion for sensibility was already on the wane. So at this point, we get a kind of reaction to the extremes of sentimentalism, so to speak. The term sentimentality starts to be used pejoratively, suggesting a sort of debasement and indulgence in emotion for its own sake, a kind of sensational exploitation of feeling. And in the aftermath of the French Revolution especially, the idea of sensibility is kind of bandied about as a political tool, so that by those opposed to political change, sensibility is identified with radicalism or Jacobinism, as it was known, and blamed for promoting unrest. But political radicals, on the other hand, align sensibility with their opponents, identifying it with regressive nostalgia and emotional hypocrisy. So you begin to get, you know, a kind of general reaction against the whole idea of sensibility. Now, I hope you can see how we can play this back onto the sorrows of young Werther. You'll have to, you know, think about how far the idea of the cult of sensibility is a useful way of thinking about that novel. But Love and Friendship immediately declares itself to the reader as a kind of spoof of the novel of sensibility, of sentimental excess, through the typographical devices it employs. These would have been very familiar to those who had read just a few novels of sensibility. The use of exclamation marks, dashes, broken sentences, meandering narrative, all these effectively kind of buttonhole the reader, forcing the reader to respond to the emotions, to respond to the extremity of the emotion, rather than to identify with, say, a particular character. It's the emotion, which the force of the emotion, that matters. Now, as Love and Friendship also suggests, in our account of Augustus and Edward, my life, my soul, my adorable angel, and so on, the idea of sensibility was initially ungendered. Men and women were kind of equally capable of experiencing the heightened and delicate and refined emotions that sensibility was supposed to incite. But in time, sensibility came to be located especially on the female body, on what was assumed to be women's particular capacity for spontaneous emotion, expressed through a propensity to tears, palpitations, blushing and fainting. So we fainted alternately on a sofa. Now, Love and Friendship is full of ardent expressions of exquisite emotion. It's full of also of violent action, and it's also full of flagrant bad behavior on the part of its young protagonists, who routinely disobey their parents, elope with fortune hunters, run up debts and refuse to settle them, rob their mothers and leave them to starve, and so on. So, you know, this is at the tail end of the cult of sensibility, and Austin is having a good time laughing at the excesses of emotion which don't tally with the kind of behaviour that they're covering, so to speak. Okay, so the novel we're discussing today, Emma, it's clear that it couldn't be more different. Some of the earliest readers complained that Emma had no story, that nothing happens. Sympathetic with that view? What does happen in Emma?
Nothing.
A resounding silence. Okay. Well, it seems as though you're kind of going along with the idea that that Emma is not perhaps distinctive for its story. And indeed, the novel's opening sentence seems to draw attention to this. Emma Woodhouse, handsome, clever, and rich, with a comfortable home and happy disposition, seemed to unite some of the best blessings of existence and had lived nearly 21 years in the world with very little to distress or vex her. So, in other words, what's the story? You know, where's the drama? Emma has everything that she could possibly want. She has everything that most heroines achieve after endless trial and turmoil. So where can this possibly go, right? Now, in a lengthy review of Emma, published in the year of the novel's publication, Sir Walter Scott made very much the same point about Austen's novel, that not a lot happens. But for Scott, this is one of the novel's great virtues. Scott acclaims Emma as heralding a major and much-needed shift in the development of the novel. Until now, Scott says, the novel has been the child of the romance, as he calls it, the child of the romance. The novel has been stuffed full of improbable adventures in which the hero defeats whole armies with a single sword, and the heroine is in constant danger of abduction. And this is next bit is Scott sort of parodying the typical plot of the novel of his period. Even if she escaped the terrors of masked ruffians and insidious ravisher, a cloak wrapped forcibly around her head, and a coach with the blinds up driving she could not conjecture whither, she still had her share of wandering, of poverty, of obloquy, of seclusion and of imprisonment, and was frequently extended upon a bed of sickness and reduced to her last shilling before the author condescended to shield her from persecution. Okay, so that Scott is presenting it as the typical plot of the novel at the time when Emma appears. Now, so Scott is hailing Emma as an example of a new genre, a genre which doesn't depend on shock or titillation, but which relies, says Scott, on the art of copying from nature as she really exists. The art of copying from nature as she really exists. In the common walks of life, and presenting to the reader, instead of the splendid scenes of an imaginary world, a correct and striking representation of that which is duly taking place around him. Okay, so he says that Austen, by confining herself, as he says, to the middling classes of society, and drawing on her own knowledge of the world, by keeping to common incidents, and to such characters as occupy the ordinary walks of life, characters who, he says, conduct themselves upon the motives and principles which the readers may recognize as ruling their own and most of their acquaintances, by looking at common incidents, characters who occupy the ordinary walks of life. Austen's novels, he says, inculcate the kind of moral which applies to the paths of common life. So he's saying, okay, she's saying, She gives us a faithful picture, a true picture of ordinary people living ordinary lives, and thus she inculcates the kind of moral which we can recognize, with which we can identify, rather than something that is remote from everyone's experience. So Scott praises Emma as the harbinger of a new genre, the genre which came to be known as the novel of domestic realism, which would dominate the 19th century literary fictional scene. So in this review, the only lengthy review of Emma, which appeared in Jane Austen's lifetime, in this review, Walter Scott establishes the terms by which Jane Austen would come to be perceived as a realist, a miniaturist, a moralist, and a faithful chronicler of everyday life, right? A realist, a miniaturist, a moralist, a faithful chronicler of everyday life. Now, later on in this lecture, what I'm hoping to do is to unsettle some of those terms. But for now, I want to go along with Scott's account of Austen for the time being, but also to stand back from it for a moment. Because it's important to emphasize, I think, that behind Jane Austen lies a very long tradition of fiction by women writers. Many of the authors of fictions of sensibility and its allied genre, the Gothic, were women. The centrality of the heroine, the development of female consciousness, have been there in the novel from the start. And indeed, by the end of the 18th century already, women were seen, whether accurately or not, as dominating the fictional field. Nancy Armstrong, for one, has suggested that the novel initially developed as a feminized form. And she argues that the rise of the novel coincides with the rise of the woman writer. And you can find a fuller account of this in your interest, if you're interested, in Nancy Armstrong's book, Desire in Domestic Fiction. But why? Why should the rise of the novel coincide with the rise of the woman writer? Well, one important factor here is the emerging concept of women, as the sex with a special responsibility for moral education, with a particular capacity for empathy, and therefore for guidance in the realm of the emotions. Women's writing becomes acceptable as a manifestation of woman's mission, but only if the writers were prepared to stay within the boundaries of what was to be considered feminine, modestly sort of exercising their influence from within their feminine sphere, limiting their subject matter, and emphasizing the importance of womanly duties, the novelist as governess, in fact. Okay, so if Armstrong is right to see the novel as a feminized form, and I think she substantially is, then I think we can see in some 19th century fiction, including some of the novels that you'll be looking at later, a certain implicit or explicit resistance to that feminization. In Great Expectations, for example, I think we can trace a kind of steady movement away from the female mentor, the power of the female mentor, towards male camaraderie and bonding. But for today's purposes, I think we can see that both the novel of sensibility and the novel of domestic realism, at least in their original impetus, sort of lend themselves to the expectations of and constraints upon the woman writer, as novels which set out to educate, to improve, to offer guidance. Okay. Now, at this point, I want to turn to another genre in which Emma can clearly be placed. Emma is clearly, as I've said, a departure from the novel of sensibility. It takes us into a different world. It takes us into, you know, a less colourful, a more everyday, a more provincial and alternate world. And in that sense, it's a break with the tradition which The Sorrows of Young Werther represents. Although I think I should say that we can see traces of the epistolary tradition in Emma. Letters actually play a very significant part in the narrative. I mean, there's Frank Churchill's kind of letter in which he explains, what's been going on. There are Jane Fairfax's letters to her aunt. There are Jane Fairfax's excursions to the post box and so on. So, you know, the significance of the letter is certainly there and worth exploring, I think. But what Emma shares with young Werther more clearly is its place in the tradition of the Bildungsroman. The novel, what's a Bildungsroman? Coming of age novel, yes, good. Any other definitions? Novel of development, exactly. So it's the novel of development, of coming of age, of coming to moving towards maturity, of education, or another definition, the novel which traces a troubled quest for identity, and so on. So, I want to look, first of all, at the classic account, or a little extract from the classic account of the Bildungsroman, which is Franco Moretti's book, The Way of the World. And you'll find an extract from this on your handout. Now, Moretti identifies the emergence of the Bildungsroman with the emergence of capitalist modernity. Emergence of the Bildungsroman alongside the emergence of capitalist modernity. A change which Moretti argues is sort of imaged and explored in the Bildungsroman through a new understanding of a significant difference between the generations. In other words, rather than each generation essentially reproducing the behavior, the cycles of their parents, you get a new understanding of a significant difference between generations and of youth as integrally distinct from age. So here's the extract on the handout, which continues over the page. Okay, Moretti says, "When state as society starts to collapse, the countryside is abandoned for the city, and the world of work changes at an incredible and incessant pace. The colourless and uneventful socialisation of old youth becomes increasingly implausible. It becomes a problem, one that makes youth itself problematic. In dismantling the continuity between generations, as is well known, the new and destabilizing forces of capitalism impose a hitherto unknown mobility. But it is also a yearned-for exploration, since the self-same process gives rise to unexpected hopes, thereby generating an interiority not only fuller than before, but also, as Hegel clearly saw, even though he deplored it, perennially dissatisfied and restless." So this sense of youth as characterized by dissatisfaction and restlessness rather than simply following in the foots of their forebears, a sense of the sort of impetus of an undercurrent of a hitherto unknown mobility, exploration, and so on. Moretti continues, "Virtually without notice, in the dreams and nightmares of the so-called double revolution, Europe plunges into modernity, but without possessing a culture of modernity. If youth, therefore, achieves its symbolic centrality and the great narrative of the Bildungsroman comes into being, this is because Europe has to attach a meaning not so much to youth as to modernity. The image conveyed precisely by the youthful attributes of mobility and inner restlessness." So youth becomes the image in which the concept of modernity is through which it's explored extended. So modernity, the image conveyed precisely by the youthful attributes of mobility and inner restlessness. Modernity as a bewitching and risky process full of great expectations and lost illusions. Modernity as, in Marx's words, a permanent revolution that perceives the experience piled up in tradition as a useless dead weight, and therefore can no longer feel represented by maturity, and therefore less by old age. So youth is now privileged and placed at the center of the novel, in the center of this new genre of the Bildungsroman. Now, Moretti identifies two versions of the Bildungsroman, which follow two contrasting principles. Okay, he distinguishes between versions of the Bildungsroman which are kind of impelled by what he calls the classification principle, and versions of the Bildungsroman which are impelled by the transformation principle. And just try to briefly explain the difference between those two terms. In the classification model, youth is subordinated to the idea of maturity. In other words, the protagonist grows up, the protagonist matures. It has meaning only insofar as it leads to a stable and final identity, and it often concludes with marriage. So we get all this sort of the burgeoning of the restlessness and dissatisfaction and yearnings of youth, but ultimately that is sort of caged, so to speak, by a conclusion in which the protagonist settles down, fits into the social order, gets married, and has what appears at least to be a relatively stable identity. The transformation principle, by contrast, is one in which the youth, the protagonist or youth in general, resists maturity. Seeing such a conclusion, seeing such a sort of stable and enclosing conclusion as a sort of betrayal, which would deprive youth of meaning rather than enrich it. So that what we get here is an open-ended narrative, one which often focuses on adultery. Now, as you work your way through the novels on this module, you might you know, hold on to these ideas of the Bildungsroman and the classification and transformation principle. But just for today's purposes, Moretti, well, where does Austin belong? Classification or transformation? Good. Disagree with that. So somebody said classification, somebody else said transformation. That is immediately very interesting. We can come to that. Well, where Moretti places her, though it's perhaps worth saying that he's talking about Pride and Prejudice rather than Emma. He discusses Pride and Prejudice at some length. Are you familiar with Pride and Prejudice? Anyone familiar with Pride and Prejudice? Not many. Okay. Well, but anyway, he places Austin firmly in the classification camp, the closed ending, the ending of the maturity ending. But he does also go, alongside this, he argues that the Bildungsroman is an inherently contradictory form, all right? That it pulls two ways. It sets up an antagonism between, for example, freedom versus authority, right? Stable identity versus change, security versus metamorphosis, for example. So that in the sort of pairings that or oppositions that Moretti has identified, you know, the classification model would move towards authority, stable identity, security. The transformation model would move towards freedom, change, metamorphosis, and so on. But says Moretti, although these ideas are antagonistic, although they're set up within the Bildungsroman, within its form, as antagonisms, they're all equally important in practice for modern Western mentality, which in fact calls for their coexistence, and, says Moretti, also calls for a cultural mechanism capable of representing, exploring, and testing that coexistence. In other words, even within those novels which seem, you know, to be moving towards, to rest upon stability, security, and authority, and so on, you have a tension within them, which is an impulse towards its opposite. Now, I'm really sort of beginning to get on to Emma here. And at first sight, Emma doesn't seem to fit Moretti's definition of the Bildungsroman at all. Emma is famously probably the most pastoral, the most static of Austen's novels. The action doesn't move beyond Highbury. We remain within this village or small town, as we suggest. Austen's claim to be concerned with three or four families in a country village seems most of all to apply to Emma, which is, you know, a small circle of people in a very small space. So where's the restlessness, the yearning, the instability which Moretti has so firmly identified with the Bildungsroman? And at this point, I'm going to start moving more towards a workshop than a lecture, because I want you to do some thinking rather than just waiting for me to tell you. So start thinking about it. Think about Emma. Can you see any signs in that novel of instability, restlessness, yearning?
She doesn't
want to be married. Yes. Now, you could say, you could interpret that. Sorry, who said that? Very interesting, yes. Yes, she doesn't want to be married. So, but you could say that's stasis.
Yeah, because she said she's comfortable where she is. She doesn't want to
have that. Yeah, okay. Yeah, so, right, thank you. Anything, any other ways in which we might detect any signs of this?
I think her constant matchmaking is a sign of restlessness. It was a choice that she was talking by a mind of something else.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, I think that's very interesting, because in some ways you could say that Emma, moving on to what's thinking about Emma as a narrative, Emma sort of plays author, doesn't she? She does what authors are supposed to do. She starts, you know, trying to arrange marriages for her characters, which is not what she's supposed to do. She's supposed to be a character. But just to stay with the restlessness idea, yes, that suggests that yeah, that Emma has perhaps not enough to do with her time. Anything else? Yeah.
Secularism?
Yeah, go on.
She's happy that she's snowed in, so she doesn't have to attend church. Mm.
Yes, so she would rather...
Sorry. Ostentatious secularism.
Talking about religion with Austin is a tricky one, actually. But I think if we stay with Emma, yeah, she doesn't seem to be perhaps as concerned with her, you think, with her, the practice of her religious faith as custom might expect. Is that what you're saying?
Well, she just blatantly disregards it. She just doesn't care. She's,
good. Yeah. Thank you. Anyone else? Yeah?
I think probably Frank Churchill more embodies that kind of modern, romantic, sort of young person more than Emma.
Mm-hmm. Go on.
Just in that he sort of criticises her a lot. He's not made out to be a good character at all. So is she sort of criticising her sensibility, sort of the Werther-esque hero, that he's sort of unreliable, he's foppish and
but also a romantic figure, yeah. And I think just staying with Frank Churchill and the whole idea of restlessness, I mean, if there's movement in the novel, and there is actually a lot of movement in the novel, even though we're sat with one bed. Frank Churchill, he goes off to London to get a haircut. He's constantly, and unpredictably, isn't he, moving in and out of Highbury, suddenly turning up, suddenly disappearing. So, yes, that certainly, I think that we can see that restlessness is embodied in Frank Churchill. Anyone else?
So, not only does he move himself, but when he's in Emma's space, he moves, he's disruptive, he moves stuff around within quite normally static spaces.
Yes, that's a very good point, actually. Yes, so that nothing is allowed to settle, so to speak. Yeah, good. Anything else? Yes? Exactly, and I think, you know, what that's one of the things that we can sort of turn the whole idea of the pastoral idyll of Highbury round, can't we, and say alongside this kind of celebration of, you know, the peace and tranquility and knowing everybody, is this sense of claustrophobia, of a repetitive and monotonous existence, a very narrow circle of people. Yeah, and I mean, Walter Scott, in the review of Emma, which I mentioned earlier, suggests that the novel's only flaw is that it's sometimes too realistic. He says characters like Miss Bates and Mr. Woodhouse are, you know, very funny in small doses, but really we get rather too much of them. He says, if too often brought forward or too long dwelt upon, their prosing is apt to become as tiresome in fiction as in real society. But maybe that's the point. You see what I mean? That that sense of people, however beloved Mr. Woodhouse may be, however much you may respect Miss Bates and sympathise with Miss Bates, they are very irritating. And so that sense, I think, is also there. And, you know, as I said, behind the pastoral sort of tranquility of Highbury, as people have been suggesting, we can detect also claustrophobia, tedium, the boredom of familiarity. Highbury is a place where a dance at the local pub is a big event, is the event of the year, where the arrival of a piano is, you know, food for endless sort of speculation and gossip and so on. And the intrusion of a group of gypsies is a source of turmoil and terror. So it's a highly enclosed space. And you might say that too much of Mr. Woodhouse or Miss Bates might possibly drive you to the impulse to behave badly, to say something outrageous, however much that might be regretted. So, as I was saying, we've got this sort of, there's a lot of movement, in fact, going on in this novel. Not only Frank Churchill's unpredictable comings and goings, but also the sort of frequent allusions to the mysterious goings on in Ireland and so on. Okay, so there is a sense of elsewhere. Now, the question I'm moving towards of how far Austen's novels can be seen as critiquing the world which she describes has been much discussed and much debated. I suppose this was initiated by an essay by D.W. Harding called Regulated Hatred, in which he presented us with an Austen who was a very angry satirist, a satirist who concealed beneath the veneer of polite irony a very sharp critique of the failures of the life that she observed. And a major player in this debate has been Marilyn Butler, immensely influential book called Jane Austen and the War of Ideas. Now, what Butler did in this book was to take issue with the traditional view of Jane Austen as non-political, concerned only with the minutiae of everyday life, not concerned with the Napoleonic Wars and so on, and also with the later view of Austen as a sort of subversive critic of her world. Now, Butler, in Jane Austen and the War of Ideas, changed the terms of the debate, really, by saying, no, Jane Austen was a Tory. She was an anti-Jacobin through and through, who consistently upheld the values and interests of her class, the lesser gentry, and systematically rejected the values and modes of behaviour associated with the revolutionary spirit. They may be expressed, but ultimately they need to be curbed and suppressed. Now, I mean, this is a very scholarly book. It's enormously useful in placing Austen in her cultural and political context. But what I want to look at particularly is what Butler has to say about Emma. This is number 4 on your handout. Butler says, "The final irony is that this most verbal of novels at last pronounces words themselves to be suspect. It has been called the first and one of the greatest of psychological novels. If so, it resembles no other, for its attitude to the workings of Emma's consciousness is steadily critical. Although so much of the action takes place in the inner life, the theme of the novel is skepticism about the qualities that make it up, intuition, imagination, original insight. Easily the most brilliant novel of the period, and one of the most brilliant of all English novels, it masters the subjective insights which help to make the 19th century novel what it is, and denies them validity." Now, that last sentence is very odd, I think. Easily the most brilliant novel of the period, okay. It masters the subjective insights which help to make the 19th century novel what it is, and denies them validity. So it's almost, it's a denial of what makes makes the novel, and particularly the domestic realist novel. And what I really want to suggest to you is that persuasive as Butler's account may be, and it would be interesting to hear whether you do find it persuasive, almost nothing in that statement is actually uncontroversial. So I want to just work through the arguments that Butler is making here. Let's look at the first sentence, first of all. "The final irony is that this most verbal of novels at last pronounces words themselves to be suspect." Okay, let's think about that. Do you agree? In what ways are words suspect in Emma? There are games, yes. A novel is full of games, aren't there? And they're called conundrums, riddles, charades, word games, a whole lot of different kinds. Yeah.
She supposed to be highly intelligent. She constantly misinterprets the meanings of the riddles and the charades and the word games.
Well, does she? Does she always misinterpret the meaning? Does Emma?
Sometimes.
Sorry?
She gets
what she gets that right, yes. Yes, in a sense, and I think there's a lot going on in this novel about words, isn't it? I mean, it's a novel which as we said, it's full of word games and the playing with words, the kind of playing that goes on. And sometimes it's also about the misuse of words. And that's so we can see the ways in which, and I think what you were getting at here, the ways in which the wit of Emma and Frank sometimes runs away with itself, yeah? And they are perhaps a little too dexterous with their words, impulsive with their words, and hurtful with their words. But at the same time, it seems to me that although Emma, and I'm going to just suggest this to you, and you're going to have to decide whether you agree or not, but I think that Emma explores the ways in which words can deceive and confuse, but it also suggests the ways in which words can delight and amuse. I mean, where would the novel be without words and the use of words? So we might say that Emma is as much about the pleasure of words as it is about their pitfalls, and that it makes more sense, perhaps, to see Emma as a novel about the reading process, about the process of interpretation, perhaps a novel which teaches us how to read. And I would say that very few, if any, of the readers of Emma actually get the whole novel on a first reading. Did you find that you had to read the novel again or had to turn back to it again? Yeah, in order to kind of detect exactly what is going on. So it's only upon a second reading that we can sort of decipher the way it all fits together, that we can spot the clues and the hints you missed on a first reading, and trace the red herrings, and perhaps flatter yourself with the clues that you did pick up on a first reading. And yes, I think I'm going to pause there, actually, because when turning back to Marilyn Butler's incisive account of Emma, one of the interesting things about Emma is, and indeed about Jane Austen's work generally, is that everyone seems to agree that Jane Austen is a moralist, right? She is a realist and a moralist. But no two critics seem to agree about what exactly the moral is. So let's have a pause on that for a moment, just for a minute or two. What would you say is the moral of Emma? I think you might talk to the person sitting next to you for a minute or two first, because that's rather a big question to land on you without any warning. What's the moral of Emma? Ideas. What's the moral of Emma?
Nothing matters as long as you get married. I think that's the moral of virtually all Austen novels.
Yeah, the actual content is a master. And also perhaps as long as you marry the right person?
No, just
get married. Just get married, yeah.
I don't think Emma and Mr. Knightley are very compatible.
Okay, any other morals? I like that one. Let's have some other morals, yes.
I think the moral is not to be stupid.
Uh-huh. Now, that was just going to lead me on to what I was going to say next, actually. So can I come back into that in a moment? I very much agree. But yes, okay. Anyone else? The moral of Emma?
Maybe don't take the society you live in too seriously.
Don't take the society you live in too seriously, okay. That is, seems to be almost the opposite of what Marilyn Butler is saying, but that's very interesting, yeah?
Always don't be rash in your opinions of people.
Don't be rash in your opinions of people. Anything else? Yeah?
Don't meddle,
okay.
Don't
be blinded by thinking in an over-romantic way. But you're going to get married in the end.
Sentimental.
Oh, that's interesting. Yes. Be rational. Yeah, I mean, I think that's very interesting because it comes back to this don't be stupid idea. What I was going to suggest is that, you know, first of all, I should say that there are many, many different ways of reading Jane Austen, and I'm only giving you one or two in this lecture, and you'll find feminist Jane Austens, Tory Jane Austens, you'll find imperialist Jane Austens, anti-imperialist Jane Austens. The library is full of books on Jane Austen, and you can find out some of the many positions that people have taken up. But what I was going to, you know, kind of moving on from that question of stupidity and intelligence and using your nous, it could be said that the one kind of capital which really matters in Emma is cultural capital, and that if there is a snobbery at work, it's intellectual snobbery. Emma and Frank misuse their wit, their intelligence at times, but nevertheless they're key to the pleasures that the novels afford. And if we think about, you know, why is Emma wrong to, or is she wrong? If she is wrong to pursue the friendship with Harriet and misguidedly try to marry her off to a series of men. What's the problem with Harriet?
It's illegitimate.
Yes, she is, but that doesn't seem to be the issue, because initially Emma has this wonderful fantasy that Harriet is the legitimate daughter of somebody very superior, in which case it wouldn't matter. And in fact, Harriet's parentage is obscure, isn't it, for much of the novel. What seems to matter is that Harriet, as perhaps Emma is the only one not to realize, is not very bright. Would you agree? Okay. So much of the plot hinges on sort of Emma's intellect, the ways in which she needs to make more use of her intellectual capital and so on. And to use that intellectual capital in coherent ways. But I've just got a few more minutes. I want to point quickly to a couple of recent essays which sort of question the equation of the term realism with the name of Jane Austen, both from the very useful Companion to Jane Austen, edited by Claudia Johnson and Clara Tight. And I'm just going to say briefly that the narrative mode for which Austen is most celebrated is her use of free indirect discourse. That's something you'll find in all critiques of Jane Austen, her use of free indirect discourse. That method, which allows her to sort of take us into the mind of a character, to engage with their feelings and thoughts, while at the same time remaining at some distance. And this is sometimes interpreted, or often interpreted, as a kind of controlling device, in which Austen tells us what a character thinks, and at the same time tells us what to think about what a character thinks. Okay? But there is another way of looking at this technique, as offering a kind of double or multiple vision, in which one perspective doesn't trump or displace the other, but rather sits alongside it. And this is an extract from an essay by Linda Bree, which is number 5, I think, on the handout, in which she says, "The narrative, in fact, proceeds in a variety of subtly differentiated ways. Through Emma's consciousness, a complex network of rational and irrational observations, opinions, and conclusions, through what passes for an omniscient narrative voice, narrative voice, and through unexpected and destabilizing combinations of the two, where it is not at all clear what authority is to be gleaned from a particular observation or statement. Readers trying to be certain about the direction of the narrative are very inclined to find themselves, as in a maze, following a blind alley and having to retrace their steps. In other words, she's suggesting that the idea of Austin as very clearly telling us what to think and signalling the ways, the kinds of judgments that we are to make, is actually often a misleading one. There's a lot more going on in Austin novels than that suggests. And just to mention also the sixth extract on the handout, which takes a rather different tack on Austin and realism. Sonia Hofkusch suggests that the realist paradigm that Austin is so often taken to initiate is itself apparitional, elaborated through a set of enchanted effects that rely on a dynamic of its estrangement or displacement to achieve its normative status as ordinary, immediate, or natural. Now, that's rather a mouthful, but what she's doing is, Hofkusch is doing here, is taking from Terry Eagleton the idea that, is, in Eagleton's words, realism is meant to be a riposte to magic and mystery, but it may well be a prime example of them. So, in Hofkusch's argument, to be enchanted is to be sort of struck and shaken by the extraordinariness, so to speak, that surrounds the familiar and the natural. The way in which the current of everyday life sort of moves through unexpected channels. And I think perhaps a prime example of this in Emma, which I shall conclude, is not the, as people have already suggested, the predictable marriage of Emma and Knightley. You know, everything is moving towards the marriage of Emma and Knightley, Mr. Knightley, but the more enigmatic and elusive romance of Jane Fairfax and Frank Churchill. On the face of it, this is an entirely conventional story. I mean, young, impecunious governess or potential governess attract the attention of handsome and wealthy young man. There's a clandestine engagement. They have to overcome all kinds of trials and tribulations. Eventually, the interfering kind of elder woman figure dies off and the marriage takes place. But, you know, as Linda Bree suggests, the revelation of the engagement of Jane Fairfax and Frank Churchill actually shifts the whole balance of the whole axis of the novel, in the sense that once we know about that engagement, once that engagement is revealed, everything has to be reinterpreted. We have to rethink the behavior, the motivation, the words, the encounters of virtually all of the characters in the novel. So what makes the story, I think, one of enchantment in Hofkusch's sense, is the mystery and the speculation which surround it, lifting it out of the sort of conventional story into one of what Hofkusch would call the estranged and the apparitional. Now, I talked earlier on about the contradictions inherent in the Bildungsroman, and contradictions as Moretti outlines them. But I suppose for me, and this is my take on Jane Austen, what I see in her writing constantly is the tension, the pull between her class and her gender. Throughout Emma, alongside Emma's own slightly bumpy, yet occasionally, well, essentially blithe progress towards marriage with Mr. Knightley, there's another much darker and never fully articulated story, the much messier story of the romance between Frank and Jane, in which the happy ending, I think, doesn't actually cancel out the catalogue of betrayal, delay, suspense, cruel teasing, and so on, which precedes it. So that always, alongside Emma's articulateness, her witty confidence, her mastery of words, and so on, whether or not she's using them rightly, is Jane's silence, that sort of repressed and muted presence of Jane, and the long months of kind of agonized waiting, which we eventually realize have been taking place. So it's through Jane's story, through the analogies that are drawn between governessing and the slave trade and so on, that we're given glimpses of what it's like for a single woman who isn't certainly isn't rich, although she's handsome and clever. What's it like for the single woman with an inheritance? Now, Jane Austen, as I've said, you know, for Butler, Austen's novels are simply kind of buttressing and endorsing the values and the status of the lesser gentry class. And it's certainly true that for Austen, she's surrounded by brothers who are rising in their profession, or who inherit estates from other members of the family. But after the death of her father, Austen's mother, her sister, and herself lived effectively on the edge of penury. They were dependent on handouts from other family members, handouts which, if times were hard, would simply and suddenly cease. I'm concluding then with an observation that Austen made in one of her letters, and which I think she felt on her pulse, which is that single women have a dreadful propensity for being poor. Okay, so that's